And welcome back to Speak Up Las Cruces with Walt Rubel and Peter Goodman, and for this half hour, Barry Pierce.
Barry.
You missed it.
Barry, not Barry. Sorry, you were out of the room.
Well, that leads me to ask you where your family's from, because I know you...
Both my parents are from Ireland, and so they talk funny. And
is that why we say Barry?
That's why we're saying Barry. As a little kid, in Chicago, all the accents are, the A's are very flat, so it would be like Barry, you know, and I just always heard them say it kind of in a more rounded way. So unbeknownst to myself, I was making people have an Irish accent, I guess.
Well, good. You need to be closer to the mic.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And directly right in it. Sure. Well, tell us about Plan of Chicago, your book of short stories. I mean, I've read it, but most of the people who are listening have not.
Sure, Peter, thanks. Yeah, it's a collection of 9 short stories set in Chicago. They're all linked, but each one is set in a different neighborhood. So each story has a kind of neighborhood label like Lincoln Park or Chrysler Village or whatever, and then a story title. It's really the idea was that, you know, Chicago sits pretty much in the center of the country and would be sort of a good stand-in for the United States. So I see the story as sort of, presenting a microcosm kind of the country. Most of the characters are immigrants, as you know now, and they run the gamut, you know, black, white, straight, gay. There are people from Mexico, Puerto Rico, Somalia, Poland, Ireland. So I was trying to capture sort of the breadth of the city and somewhat of the country by doing that.
One of the things I just learned about Chicago is why they call it the second city. I never knew that.
Yeah.
I guess it was because of the fire.
Well, kind of. you know, the fire was in 1871, and at that point we had about 300,000 people. And after the fire, 100,000 of them, a third of the population, was homeless.
Right, right.
And people thought we were done. People thought that was it for the city. But we started rebuilding immediately, literally while the ground was still warm. Chicago started rebuilding. 20 years later, by 1890, we had 1 million people. So we were second only to New York. Only New York had more people.
Ah, so we became the other second city.
The second city.
Gotcha.
Yeah, exactly.
Gotcha. But I'm curious. It would seem to me that that's – when you think about Chicago, one of the things you think about is kind of a tough, you know, resilient people. And I wonder how much that origin story from the fire kind of still is, you know, part of the fabric today.
I think it is. It is a scrappy place, you know. One of our politicians early on said, Chicago politics ain't beanbag, you know, like it's a sort of rough and tumble place. And I think that spirit of resilience and bouncing back is still very much a part of our, you know, we've had a lot of trouble, not quite maybe to the extent that Minneapolis has, but ICE has been in Chicago conducting major operations, and the city has really rallied together. I think, you know, in that same spirit that Minneapolis has shown. It's a tough place, but a place with a great sense of community, I think, and resilience.
One of the things that I've been fascinated with recently is, as a writer, kind of inhabiting your characters. And that's something that I think you work pretty hard at or good at or focus on, with a particular depth, whether you like them or not. Talk about that. And in terms of the experience of writing people, you know, like, for example, the woman in Enumerator, the first story. I don't think you'd like to be her, but yet you are for a while, for months.
Yeah.
How's that feel, and what would you like to tell people about that?
Yeah, well, I think the same way about fiction, Peter, as it seems you do. That to me, it's all about character and inhabiting those characters as a writer. And maybe it says something about me that I want to spend so much of my time inhabiting other people. but that is kind of what you do. You know, I think the way a method actor tries to become the role for a while, you know, you hear these stories of people like Dustin Hoffman and whoever just really getting into the role and trying to become whoever it is. So that is my approach, and I think that's what leads to a good story. And yes, oftentimes the people you don't want to be are the most fun to read about and the most fun to write about. You know, that character you mentioned is pretty selfish for a lot of that story and a little narcissistic and doesn't have a very happy experience for a long time.
No.
But she was fun for me to watch and fun for me to see grow in various ways, you know, and transition. So
how'd she come to you? Do you know anybody?
I grew up in my neighborhood growing up was pretty mixed, but there was a huge Polish population. And this character we're talking about, Margaret, is from Poland. So that felt pretty natural, you know. My best friend in high school was, his parents were from Poland. I wanted somebody, I did census work, and that's at the heart of that story. I was an enumerator, that's the name of the story. And so I wanted somebody from somewhere else to come here and sort of be counting people in the city. And for me, that's kind of became a metaphor for writing in a way, you know, that you're counting the uncounted.
Was the most interesting experience you had counting?
There were so many. I mean, my coworkers were fascinating, and that comes through in the story maybe a little.
Yes.
The coworkers are based on people I work with. It's just such a weird thing going door to door with – you know, at the homes of strangers, and you wind up going into these apartment buildings in a city like Chicago. I'm sure it's very different in Wyoming or New Mexico. But in Chicago, you wind up going in big apartment buildings. You sort of sneak in almost. You have a badge, and it's okay for you to be there, but you kind of sneak in. You are knocking on doors, and people are often pretty resistant, you know, like, there's somebody here from the government or whatever. Maybe you're not sure of their status. Who knows? You know, which is why I think if we want to count everybody, it's really important that that's not a part of the census. I just wound up having – I remember one time I had a conversation through a door with this guy who was completely resistant to me filling out his form, which at that point I could have done from the hallway, but he just would not – but I was out there for 15 minutes having this weird conversation through the apartment door, you know, negotiating.
When you're going through that, are you kind of tucking it back in your mind thinking, hey, I may be able to use this at some point down the road?
It's funny you say that, Walt. Yeah, for that story in particular, I went into the job thinking, I want to write a story about this.
Okay.
I almost never do that. Usually it's after the fact. You think, well, that was an interesting experience. It might make a good story. But in this instance, I went in, so I took notes as I went.
Right.
I don't normally keep a journal or anything, but I kind of did. I kept.
So you were intentional about it.
I was
this
so
time.
Totally yeah. intentional yeah. about that one. Yeah.
Yeah.
I even kept forms and the handbook and everything, which is illegal. I hope there are no law enforcement listening. But anyway,
How did you first get interested in, you know, when did you decide writing fiction was, you know, important to you?
Man, I mean, I never wanted to do anything other than be a writer from the time I was 8 years old or something. You know, in grade school, it's all I wanted to do. And I wasn't sure exactly what. I thought about screenplays for a while and other stuff. But I'm not sure why. I was pretty good at it as a kid, so that encouraged me. And various teachers encouraged me. It's always funny thinking back, like just an offhand comment from a teacher can sort of change your life, you know? So I remember getting some praise early on in grade school. And I remember in high school, a teacher at one point, nothing like this had ever happened to me. I'd never heard it happen to anyone else. He said, if you get a chance, you should really read this paper. And he held up my paper about, I think it was about the play, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? So anyway, that kind
of one of my favorites.
Yeah,
but yeah, positive feedback at an early age.
Yeah,
there you go.
It really helped. So, and then I was in journalism for a long time and did other kinds of writing, but fiction pretty early on became the thing I wanted to do.
Where did the title of the book come from? What the plan?
Yeah, I know a lot of people. I think Chicagoans usually
means
get
very
it.
Literally,
right. So there is the original plan of Chicago is a 1909 urban planning document that Daniel Burnham, a great architect and city planner, came up with for the city. You know, Chicago in the 19th century had been completely chaotic and had grown very haphazardly. So there wasn't a lot of organization. And he came up with this detailed plan for how the city could look and grow and change. Most of it didn't get implemented. But a couple of really big important parts did. If you've ever been to Chicago, like Michigan Avenue as it exists comes from the Burnham Plan. Wacker Drive, which has three levels, which is very efficient because you have deliveries below and commercial traffic below, the pedestrian stuff above. That comes from there, a lot of our lakefront stuff. But most of the plan did not get implemented, which is probably a good thing. It was a little naive and idealistic, almost utopian.
Right,
kind of.
Yeah.
And I think he had noble goals. He was part of this movement called the City Beautiful Movement. And the idea was that you could ennoble people and make them happier and whatever through urban planning. Good goal. But it was also a little paternalistic, a little kind of condescending and controlling.
Right.
Chicago had a wildly diverse, disparate population, and I think they were looking for ways to homogenize it a little bit. If you look at those drawings from Burnham's plan of Chicago, they're beautiful, you know, beautifully rendered and everything. But all the buildings are about the same height. It looks very much like Paris, which would be a little weird. That's not us. But anyway, that's more than anyone needs to know about Burnham's plan.
Yeah.
But so my title is kind of an ironic take on that. I realized at some point the stories all involve people whose plans are very much about the city.
Gotcha.
And those plans are often foiled by the city. You know, they don't actually realize those plans. So
right. Well, you kind of just answered my question. I when you write a book of short stories, I mean, other than just being based in Chicago, is there a unifying theme or anything that they all kind of have in common?
Well, I think, that stuff sort of emerges as you're writing. You know, it's nothing I planned out, but I think there is a lot about the American dream in here and kind of the challenges of trying to realize that, the ways that it's become very difficult to realize that, not that it was probably ever easy. And I think there is a lot of imagery kind of drawn from maybe the Garden of Eden, going back to that Burnham plan, the sort of idealized utopian vision.
Right.
You know, like that character of Margaret that you mentioned, Peter, in the first story, comes to America and comes to Chicago with these high hopes. Her life is going to be great here, and lo and behold, not so much. But
no, not hardly.
And compartmentalization, too, I'd say would be the other big one that, like, people are divided very much in the city, you know.
We should have mentioned at the beginning, my fault, that you will be reading from this book and talking about it Friday evening in the Nelson Boswell Society para las Artes.
Yeah.
Sequence in the 7:30 in the CMI Auditorium, NMSU's campus, open to everyone and it's a fun reading series, and yours should be fun.
Yeah. Those guys were both teachers of mine, too.
I know.
Antonia Nelson and Robert Boswell. So I'm thrilled to be reading here. Yeah.
And, yeah, I've met them, but I don't know them well. I know a lot of other people they taught. And, of course, Russ Bradbird, was he teaching when you were there?
He was. Or? Russ was also one of my teachers, yeah.
Yes. A recovering basketball coach.
That's right. And a phenomenal writer with many books under his belt now. And but New Mexico State is so lucky to have, you know, they've just been phenomenal writers here. And it's a great sleeper program. I think a lot of people around the country don't know how good it is, you know, which.
I'll tell you something you don't know. Who was the first person to get a master's here writing a novel for a thesis?
You. I could just tell by the way the question was asked. Hey, that's great.
Yep.
Wow.
That was a, you know, revolutionary thing. Keith Wilson and Mark
kind of
got to make it happen.
Yeah.
My sister and I were here, and I wrote a novel for my thesis. It was the first master's.
Uh-huh.
And I wrote a novel. Which was hilarious because you have to defend your thesis.
Ah, right.
And one of the people, now dead, actually killed himself. But there was a guy in a three-piece suit who was a history professor. And his whole thing was, you know, basically like Juan saying, you're jealous of billionaires. He kept saying, can you be a person? Can you wear a three-piece suit and do business and be a decent person? Sure, why not?
oh, that's funny.
What are you working on now?
A couple of things. I'm working on a novel, which is in early stages, and I can't really talk about too much. But I also have a bunch of stories I'm putting together that also have a kind of connecting theme. But the theme is architecture. Mm-hmm. So there was a novella that was supposed to go in here, which mentions the literal plan of Chicago, but it got cut for space reasons. Mm-hmm. So that's 90 pages. And then I have a couple other stories that also involve architecture. So I'm hoping to have a collection that revolves around that.
How much research into the topic do you do before you actually begin the writing process?
Before I begin the writing process, often not that much.
Okay, but as you're going.
As I'm going, yeah. and even after I have a full draft, you know, yeah. I often do more research then.
Yeah.
I think some writers don't work this way. Some writers, I have a friend who's a terrific fiction writer who is very inspired by research. For me, the research can take over, and you can start including things you don't even need.
So absolutely.
I often do it after the fact and kind of fill in, you know.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, but with the architecture stuff, I give architecture tours in Chicago through the Chicago Architecture Center, just sort of a hobby.
Like I say, it sounds like you write about stuff that you have a basic knowledge of already.
Yeah, that's pretty much, yeah. I mean, all my stuff is pretty much set in Chicago. Even, you know, I lived in New Mexico for 7 years in two different stints. And I think I probably could write about New Mexico a little now, but I just still feel like, do I have the authority to really write about New Mexico? Yeah. You know, it's a complicated place. So
Yeah, Chicago is too.
Yeah, sure.
How do you write in terms of when, you know, when during the day, what kind of setting, do you play music or not? Do you write at one stint or just any time during the day?
Metallica, Peter. It's got to be Metallica. Cranked all the way up.
I was going to say, up to 11.
Yes, up to 11. No, I don't. I need total silence. I need to be in my desk, in my study. And this is terrible. If there are writers listening, this is a terrible habit. But I kind of need 8 hours. Like, I need a full day. I have friends I'm so jealous of who write for an hour or 2 hours here or there, and I just can't get anything done in an hour or 2 hours. So I need a long stretch and my coffee cup and my chair.
Your coffee's essential.
Yes, absolutely.
Does a story typically start with a character, or does it start with an event? How do you dive into it? How do you get started?
Yeah, man, it's all over the map, Walt. Like, often it's a character and someone's in your head. It could be loosely based on someone you met or know, or just a single trait of that person maybe, or an event from their life. Or sometimes it's just an image that keeps recurring to you. And sometimes it's something that happened that you think, man, there's got to be a way to work that into a story. I many years ago had a girlfriend who volunteered for this group called Rape Victim Advocates. And so back in those days, she had a beeper. And whenever it went off, it meant someone had been raped and she had to go. And I would often drive her to those things. And that was one of those things where it started with that kind of image of the beeper and that job she had. So
you've probably always wanted to be asked this question by somebody else. Because I'm stealing it. If you could, if we were having a party tonight, what three writers, living or dead, would you invite?
Wow. The party throws an interesting twist in there.
There's an interview in the New York Times Book Review every week, and they ask that question.
That's funny.
And I like it, and I like some of the answers, but I didn't make it up. Can't claim that.
William Trevor would be at the top of the list. Terrific writer who Irish writer. Died not that long ago, and I'm it's tragic. I never got to see him read or meet him. This is a controversial one now. Alice Munro is one of my favorite writers of all time. She's faced a little postmortem controversy, but I still love her work and would love to meet her there. Maybe I would invite my old friend Toni Nelson, who is also one of my favorite writers. I'd definitely put her in the top five short story writers. And she's also great fun at a party. So
I sat with her when Russ and Dennis and somebody else were playing Irish fiddle at the Spotted the bar dog. Up here.
Oh, nice.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that's really the only long conversation I've had with Antonio, uh-huh. I think.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was fun.
Nice.
So I agree with you. What would you, I don't know if you also teach writing, but what would you tell folks who are out there and aspire to write or do write some? What would you share with them that might help them along or that they might appreciate?
Well, I would say you have to love the writing itself. So if you're interested in it because you think you're going to have some measure of fame or the parties are going to be great or some forget about anything, forget about the business
get
end
a lot of
it.
Sex.
Yes, right. I can attest that that's not happening.
Often
groupies are not there. Because, I spent a decade trying to publish this book, and the business end of it sucks.
Yeah. Yes.
So if you didn't love the writing part, the rest of it, you need to just write off the rest of it. Hopefully something happens, you publish a book or whatever, but it's got to be about the writing.
Yeah, that's for sure.
We talk, I hate when people's names escape me. The NMSU economist.
Not Chris, the one who wrote the book.
Yeah. Anyway, we interviewed about his book, and the thing that he said that surprised me a little bit, he said the most difficult thing for him was dialogue, that every time he would send it to his editor, it would come back saying, nope, needs more dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And so, creating those conversations is something that, as a journalist, you just never do. And so I would think your imagination has to be – can you talk a little bit about that process?
Yeah, sure. I think dialogue goes faster for me in writing than exposition, but I think it is difficult, and there's always that kind of – what this writer Dagoberto Gilb, who spent some time here and used to be in Texas – used to be in El Paso, I guess, he used to call the scratch and sniff test, does it really feel authentic? Yeah. And I think for me, that's the trick with dialogue. I write it faster than other stuff, but then going back, does that really sound right,
I find more and more that the characters just run away with it.
They get
yapping and they're, I'm like, oh, wow, they said all that.
That's great, yeah.
And they say shit I didn't expect them to say. And,
yeah.
But. Yeah.
Takes a little work off you, Peter, right?
And I sure find that there are times when I sit there thinking I'm a complete lump. I've never written anything worth a damn, and I'm not about to. And I'm hopeless and helpless and lost. And then some idea or a bit of dialogue or something starts happening, I would say on that page, but on the screen. And, I just watch it happen.
Yeah, nice. That's great. I mean, and that goes back to what you were saying about character. Like, if you're really inhabiting the characters and they feel developed,
When you were saying what you were saying in response to the question about teaching writing, but an old shibboleth, write what you know. In some senses, you obviously do that. In some other senses, you very clearly don't. You've probably never done what Margaret does toward the end. You've certainly never, I doubt you've been in the 1990s a black woman having an affair with a white woman.
Safe guess.
Yeah.
How would you respond to somebody who says you have to write what you know?
I think I agree with you. I think you're saying you don't have to do that. And
asking the question.
It's one of the reasons we write, isn't it? That, you want to inhabit other people. And if you
discover.
If you only wrote about yourself, if I only wrote about middle-aged straight white guys, that would get boring.
You're not middle-aged yet. You got a long way to go, pal.
That would get boring really quickly. But there is a whole school now, maybe it's dying down a little bit, of people who think really you can only write about yourself. The project for this book, The Plan of Chicago, was to write about the whole city. So in a way you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. Like if I only wrote about straight middle-aged white guys, me – people would say that doesn't reflect
it'd be
city
boring
at all.
Yeah,
you know,
if you only had a minute, to say whatever you want to say to our audience, what would you say? Because
we're
down to a couple of minutes.
If there's one thing to take away from the book, I think it's that there's more that unites us than there is that divides us. These characters are often very separated and very compartmentalized by neighborhood or race or ethnicity or class or whatever. But they also have these collisions, and there are moments of connection and communion, I think, between them. And I think if we could all remember that, as a country, we would be much, much better off.
Yeah.
Want to reiterate that we are talking with Bari, not Barry.
And we should let people know again one more time when your reading is going to be.
Bari Pierce, who is going to read Friday evening this week at the... I was headed there.
Okay, I'm sorry.
But thank you. in the Sociedad para las Artes, or Nelson Boswell, you may prefer it that way, series of readings. But it'll be at the CMI Theater, New Mexico campus. That's kind of on the circle there where Corbett Center is and the theater used to be. KRWG is. So yeah. People go there, and it is open to everybody and free and, you know, should be fun. Anything more you want to tell folks about your reading / talk?
Not really. Yeah, it's at 7:30. There's also a opening act, a graduate student who, by all accounts, is supposed to be a great writer. Anna Coleman, I think is her name, is reading.
Yeah, we go to a lot of those, I hate to say it, I won't apply it to this one, but it happens that we prefer the graduate students sometimes to the pro.
Could be the case tonight, Peter. We'll see what happens.
Anyway, great to talk to you, Bari. I'll probably see you at the reading tonight.